So I wanted to take some time now to reflect a little bit more extensively around this theme of metta, and then afterwards I have some time if you have any questions or reflections. So one of the earliest collections of the Buddhist teaching is called the Sutta Nipata, and I think it's pretty widely recognized as being some of the most authentic renderings of the early teachings. And this is where the discourse or the teaching of metta is found. And as we've talked about already today, it is really describing the greatest possibility of the human heart, the possibility for an unshakable friendliness, kindness, care, immeasurable, it is called. And that immeasurable nature of it means that there's nothing and no one left out. And this is a thread of a quality or a theme of the teaching that doesn't arise only in this one sutta. In fact, if any of you ever read any of the texts, you see it repeated over and over again, that this is why we practice. This is our intention of how to live in this world, that this is one of the greatest aspirations of the practice. And it's very much pointed to as being one of the key elements for bringing about the end of suffering and alienation and estrangement and conflict, whether that is outwardly experienced or whether it is inwardly experienced. And the Buddha really speaks of metta as a quality that brings nobility. It ennobles the heart. And I know many people in the West, you know, have struggled a little bit with this word noble or ennobling, you know, when they sit around in their sweatpants and struggle to find a breath or two. You know, it seems like a very big word, you know, noble. And yet the Buddha didn't apply this just to monastics. He said this is really what the path is about. And ennobling really refers to a life of dignity, a life of respect, a life without regrets, and probably a life in which we make a difference. We make a difference, not in dramatic, huge ways, but in the kind of footprint that we leave upon the world, recognizing that, you know, with every thought, with every word, with every act, we leave a footprint upon the world and upon our own heart. And in that sense, metta is a way of actually taking care of the footprint that we leave. And very often when the Buddha would speak about nibbana, I know, which we usually think of as a capital N, liberation with a capital L, he actually speaks also of this as a pathway, you know, of liberating the moment. And one of the ways that the Buddha speaks about nibbana, or the kind of that quality of heart and mind, is as a heart and mind without residues. Without the residues of regret and should and remorse. You know, I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I had said this. I wish I hadn't done that. And I think we can all be all too familiar with residues. It's what keeps us awake at night. You know, it's where our minds go back to, the sort of unfinished symphony that we sing. And certainly for me, the more that I teach and the more that I practice, the more do I really feel and understand how very thin the membrane is that separates metta from all other practices of meditation. You know, we could ask, you know, what is metta without mindfulness? Well, it couldn't come into being, because metta is a present moment cultivation that requires mindfulness. We could ask, what is mindfulness without metta? And I think it would often be experienced as a kind of a cold glare of attention. rather than as an act of caring. And one of the translations of metta that I'm particularly fond of is this willingness to stand near to, or the willingness to stand next to. We don't have to love what we're standing near to. We don't have to love, you know, the chronic pain or the chronic illness. But we may be able to stand near to it. If we look at this relationship between mindfulness and metta, you see how mindfulness is turning the tide of abandonment, isn't it? Mindfulness is about turning the tide of disconnection. So the very nature of mindfulness is to turn towards the moment. And then metta comes as a close companion to that, because it's the willingness then to stand near to or to stand next to what has been turned towards. And my own sense is we can see the truth of this in our own experience, that we don't really understand another person or really understand anything from a distance, from a place of disconnection. We don't forgive often from a distance. We don't find joy and generosity from a distance. And, you know, compassion is not some kind of remote offering. And most of us in our life, you know, time and time again, we're asked to stand near to joy and to stand near to sorrow, to stand near to heartache and to fear, to people we love and people that we struggle with. We're often asked to stand near to both the difficult and the lovely emotions and thoughts and everything that our bodies can and will experience. And this is almost like the invitation of our life, and we see how often it is easy to turn down that invitation and to use the variety of strategies we have to distance and to disconnect, or even to sink into numbness, as this is some kind of refuge. But then this is a life not lived. This is a life that we're endeavoring to escape from. And, you know, you really see how that is kind of almost like a universal and almost a historical, a timeless story when you go back to the kind of spiritual landscape in the time of the Buddha, you know, when it was all about transcendence. And it's probably understandable. I am quite convinced that life in India 2,600 years ago was probably pretty tough. You know, and you really can understand and have empathy for that impulse to get out of it. You know, and so, you know, the Buddha tried all those strategies to get out of it, you know, and the strategies available at that time were, you know, mortification of the body or trying to suppress the mind through concentration states. But it's also, it is a pretty timeless story, isn't it? I mean, we don't go around, you know, lying on beds of nails or, you know, mortifying the body this way or the other, but we certainly see the impulse pretty prevalent in our culture and perhaps in our own lives to get out of it, you know, to disconnect, to depart. And the Buddha didn't completely dismiss the idea of transcendence, but he spoke not so much of transcending the world or life, but of transcending suffering. And transcending suffering through its understanding and through compassion and through metta. Now, my own sense that this is a developing capacity we really nurture, this willingness to be equally present with all experiences and events in our lives, with warmth, with friendliness. And it is the ground of insight. It's probably the first, most significant step we ever make on this path. Certainly what I see in meditative practice and environments is that the biggest step most people make in their practice is that shift from aversion to befriending. I can hardly even think of one that is more transforming, more radical, and more illuminating than to be able to make that inner shift from aversion to that capacity to befriend. Tartan Tuku, he says, loving compassion is like sunlight, awakening and bringing joy to beings. Its beauty is like a rainbow, lifting the hearts of all that it touches. Metta not only has a direct relationship with mindfulness and with insight, but it is also the base or the foundation of all of the other qualities that are referred to as the Brahma Viharas. If we wish to understand compassion, it is built upon the foundation of metta. If we wish to understand the nature of joy, we're asked to understand what it means to stand near to all things and develop that capacity to be touched. And if we wish to understand equanimity, a quality of unshakable poise and balance, it begins with understanding what metta is. These are all interwoven qualities, they're not separate. Longchenpa, there's a beautiful quote from Longchenpa, I think, that describes this. He says, out of the soil of friendliness grows the bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy, and sheltered beneath the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. It's kind of what brings them all together in this kind of wholeness, the landscape of the heart. Now, I think one of the places where people get confused a little bit around metta is to feel that it's an emotion. You know, to feel that it just is an emotion amongst a big spectrum of our emotions. But I think it's not this at all. I think metta can be present in the midst of the whole of our emotional spectrum. We can befriend loneliness, we can befriend envy, we can befriend resentment, we can befriend judgment, just as we can befriend joy and empathy. So in this sense, metta is always much more in the realm of an attitudinal commitment. It's an attitudinal commitment to how we are present within our emotional world and within our much wider world. Because if metta is considered to be an emotion, then it's existing in a state of tension and often in a state of contradiction with other emotions. You know, and we think, well, if we're feeling very angry, there can't possibly be metta, or that it denies metta. It's not so. We're actually learning to befriend that. So it is relational. Our way of being present with the waves of thought and body sensation and emotions that we experience, our way of being present with this much wider world of people and events and experiences that make up our world of the moment. And it's a path. In this teaching, it's presented as a path that is cultivated. Just as we cultivate our capacity for attention, our capacity for mindfulness, metta is a capacity. It is a capacity to be cultivated. But it is also something to be enacted. It is something to be manifested. And this is where I think it needs to come out of the world of emotion. Because, you know, we don't have to love something to befriend it. We don't have to feel extremely positive about something in order to care for it. A couple of years ago, I went to a workshop that was offered by this group of Israeli and Palestinian activists who called themselves they called themselves combatants for peace, is how they referred to themselves. And they offered this evening, I found it quite remarkable, because this group of people, these Israelis and Palestinians, some of them didn't even share any common verbal language. And they all had, of course, a really terrible history of war and conflict and violence and alienation. Most of them, it was the only life they had known since they were born. And they stood up, a few of them, and they told the stories of their lives. They told the stories of seeing family members being killed. They told the stories of one young man, 27 years old, who'd spent 12 of his years of his life in an Israeli prison. You know, they told the stories of killing others that they hated. And they all spoke of the ways in which this kind of climate of hatred and mistrust and suspicion had permeated their lives as long as they could remember. And so there was, even despite the kind of extremes of their positions, it was almost, that was the common language. The language of hatred, the language of mistrust and suspicion. And they all spoke in different ways about the turning points that they'd come to in their own lives, where they really firmly saw that they didn't want their past to be their future. And committed themselves to this peace work they were doing. And this was not easy, because they saw, you know, very much, and they talked about this, the way that we see the ways in which our histories and our pasts arise again and again in the present, with our memories, with our stories of hurt, with our resentments, with our reactions. And this is where metta is cultivated. How do we stand near to all of this? And to know deeply that there is a possibility of walking another pathway. To know that just as the memories and stories and the historical resentments and injuries may arise in the present, so too does the possibility of either reinforcing them and feeding them and dwelling upon them, or the possibility of coming to know through a conscious cultivation of metta what it is to actually radically change the shape of our mind in a moment. And that is the invitation of metta. And to know that to be able to change the shape of our mind in a moment is in reality to change the shape of our world in a moment. Now I found myself really deeply touched by the size of the undertaking of this group of Palestinians and Israelis, what they'd committed to, because not only did they share this past of hatred and mistrust, but in choosing to walk the pathways they did, they were mostly forsaken, all of them, by their families, by their communities. This did not win applause, did not win popularity. So their path was two simultaneous pathways. One was to change that this ancient history, this historical legacy of reactivity, and the other was how that was going to be manifested in their life. So they would walk after bulldozers and replant trees that had been knocked down. They would safeguard children going to school. They would come into settlements that had been razed and help to rebuild them. And a lot of times during this workshop, they were quite uptight with each other. And it wasn't like it was all lovey-dovey, you know. They were actually quite uptight with each other in moments, and they could just see it and stop. And you could really have a sense that to love each other was absolutely to ask too much. But to be able to stand near to each other was possible. And I think that was the commitment of the metta, translated into intentionality and manifested in thoughts, words, and acts. And some people refer to metta as being rather sentimental. I'm always astonished at how much courage and fearlessness it actually takes to walk different pathways in our lives, to actually not follow the tides of aversion and hatred. Now, why, it's always a question of why did the Buddha actually give the teaching of metta so much emphasis? And I think what happened for the Buddha, he actually looked at his own heart and mind in the time that he lived, that he looked at the world around him and essentially saw the destructive power of ill will. The way that it poisoned communities, the way that it poisoned relationships, the way that ill will kind of leached joy and freedom from life and stifled capacities for authenticity and integrity and compassion. And I think the Buddha always spoke from his own experience. I think he actually spoke of the ways that he experienced that ill will really only had one outcome, which was to perpetuate estrangement, to perpetuate disconnection, and to create more suffering in every area of life. And any of you who are familiar with the Buddha's teaching kind of know the ways in which, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are spoken of as these kind of interwoven threads that just keep us spinning wheels, repetitive wheels of discontent and suffering and alienation. And that actually to understand one of these threads is to untangle the whole knot of confusion. So metta is primarily focused on one of these threads. And the as an insight practice, the thread that metta is really focused upon is the power of ill will. It is that particular tendency. The Buddha once said, he said, for one who actively develops metta, mindfully and without limit, they will see their clinging fade and their bonds become worn thin. This doesn't sound like a concentration practice, does it? We'll see their clinging fade and their bonds become worn thin. I would stress the word he uses here of actively. He doesn't talk about passively or just waiting. One who actively cultivates metta. So the question is, where do we actively cultivate metta? I guess the answer to that is obvious. Not in the most pleasant, lovely, contented moments of our life. The places, because there, metta is more effortless, isn't it? Where we actively cultivate metta are actually in all the moments where ill will and aversion arises. The flickers of ill will. Because that is the place where we tend to flee. Now, ill will is a curious term, isn't it? It has a lot of faces. I mean, there's many, many grosser forms of ill will in terms of hatred and blame and contempt and condemnation, in pretty much the base of all the forms of prejudice and oppression we experience in this life. But it has a lot of subtle faces, you know, irritation, impatience, frustration, annoyance, and particularly in judgment. And this is often where kind of Westerners tend to excel. You know, this particularly developed form of ill will in terms of self-blame and self-judgment and comparing and self-condemnation. But my thinking is, I think ill will can even manifest as numbness. You know, we just check out. We don't want to be where we are. We don't want to be with whatever is happening, and we just check out. I think ill will even manifests in some strange way as fantasy. Because isn't fantasy another way of kind of like, I don't like what's going on, I'm going to create something more exciting, more interesting, some other place to be. Now, if we see that the inclination of metta and mindfulness is to turn towards all events and experiences, it's pretty obvious to us, isn't it, that the inclination of ill will or aversion is actually to turn away from, to deny, to reject, to avoid, to suppress, to resist. In the Tibetan tradition, there's this jewel of a teaching that says, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of the passions that lead us to embrace all sentient beings with compassion. But we should be afraid of the passions that lead us to abandon any sentient being. And if we think of the passion that leads us to abandon others, to lead us to abandon what is, it is primarily the passion of ill will. Now, cultivating metta in the midst of ill will, I think, is truly an insight practice. It's not about just feeling good. It's about understanding what keeps this toxic power of ill will going, keeps it alive. Because isn't it true that ill will, and it's probably no stranger to anybody, isn't it true that it's the most contradictory pattern in the sense that it is so opposite to what we most deeply long for and treasure? I mean, most of us, you know, we long for and we treasure intimacy, acceptance, care, compassion, friendliness. And yet ill will keeps taking us away or to places very far from where we wish to be. Now, one aspect of ill will, and sometimes it's useful to kind of reflect, if you can, or remember on your most recent encounter with ill will. You might not have to go too far, by the way. This might not be a sort of treasure hunt, an archaeological dig, you know, through memory. But think of what happens when ill will is present. And one thing that becomes apparent, if we really look at those moments, is how the voice of selfing becomes so much stronger and louder in the presence of ill will. You know, it's almost as if ill will has this codependency or this interwoven nature with a kind of centralization of me. So you notice when ill will is present, how that voice of selfing becomes so much stronger, so much louder, the narrative becomes much bigger, doesn't it? There's a lot of narrative around ill will, you know, why I feel like this, what you've done to me, why I hate this, you know, why I'm right to feel this, you know. So the narrative and the selfing and the ill will are all very much tied in together, and they all become much more insistent. I don't like this. Now, what happens if you look at that? When the voice of selfing and the ill will and the narrative get woven in together in this way, become so insistent, what happens in exactly the same moment is the magnification of the sense of the other. You know, who you are, what I don't like about you, you know, what you've done wrong, you know, how the many ways you annoy me. And how that sense of other, of course, is completely constructed on the basis of seizing upon fragments, for example, of another person, and then with the narrative mistaking those fragments to be the whole. You are. This is the entirety of you. You know, you're a very annoying person. You know, there's no room in there for any other thing to be possible. You're just a really irritating person. Now, what is also interesting is the other is not always external, is it? The other is sometimes part of our own being. The emotion we can't accept. you know, the illness that we can't accommodate, you know, the pain that we're afraid of, the thoughts or the obsessions that we hate or fear. So sometimes the other is actually the internal other. But exactly the same mechanism happens. The more that we focus, the more the aversion is going, the more does the story get bigger, the more does the other become the enemy, the intruder, that to be disdained. And actually, this is how we create fragmentation within ourselves. You know, in many ways, this is the work of the inner critic, isn't it? This is the work of the inner judge, is actually to isolate a fragment of our own being and to mistake it to be the whole. So we see the effect of that in ourselves. And it is so important, I think, to find in ourselves a kind of gentleness and the curiosity and the almost the tenderness to explore this landscape of ill will in all its forms, rather than heaping ill will upon ill will, which again, Western practitioners tend to specialize in. You know, it was bad enough before you started practicing, you just tried to get through life as a reasonably decent person. You know, now you have to be a kind person, you know, and you have to be a compassionate person, and you have to be a mindful person, you know. So actually the ways that we heap ill will upon ill will when we fail to meet our own idealized standards of perfection, you know, I shouldn't be so angry, you know, I shouldn't be so frustrated, I shouldn't be so impatient. Now, metta, I think, teaches us really to touch all moments with kindness, including the moments of aversion. This is not exempt from metta. Metta doesn't come after aversion is over. It's very much how we touch the moments of aversion. Now, it perhaps becomes equally clear to us, and I think, you know, a lot of meditation practice is actually learning from our own experience and learning to read the landscape of our own experience and learning to read within the landscape of our experience what it is that leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. Because what also becomes apparent to us is that when ill will is not present, when there are those moments of mindfulness, when there are those moments of unhesitating kindness or generosity, and the truth and the light of all the wholesome and skillful qualities, what becomes really evident is how the voice of selfing, the volume of it, gets turned right down. You know, if you reach out to another person on the street, you know, to open a door, to make way for another person, you don't walk away from that thinking, you know, why did I do that? You know, it must be that. You know, you don't walk away with those residues, do you? You walk away, the mind is kind of clear, and the voice of selfing becomes so much more transparent. And I think it's so useful for us to notice in our days in what kind of climate does the idea of a separate and a fragile and a fearful self arise and thrive? And in what kind of climate does that begin to fall away and to fade? Now, much of the practice of metta is actually devoted to dispelling this illusion of a separated self and other, substantial, disconnected, estranged, to understanding how that construction of self and other actually is something that happens moment to moment. And actually, you know, the very basis of metta practice is beginning to be able to look around us. And as the Buddha says, you know, as I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. And this is not a kind of statement of mediocrity. You know, this is actually a statement of potentiality. To actually perceive the human story of the longings for kindness, respect, both in ourselves and in others. A deepening in this path, I think, depends a lot on us learning to be tender with all things. With the person we judge and intrudes upon us, with the person who is harsh or we perceive as being cold, to know in some moment we all have the potential to be so. And to really, really actually begin to see how many of our stories of self and other are so historical that we can't even trace their beginnings. But what we actually have is where we are just now. So what are the conditions that ill will actually rests upon? Because it doesn't arise out of a vacuum, you know. Ill will arises out of conditions. And perhaps it's obvious that the primary condition for the arising of any quality of mind that's unskillful is actually the identification with me. But more than the identification with me, it's often the identification with a fearful me, sense of a fragile me. Now, actually, we see how we are in a process of in an ongoing way, defining ourselves. We define ourselves by what we identify with, don't we? I mean, if all of us sat down and we wrote a short autobiography beginning with the words, I am, how often we define ourselves by what we identify with, but very often we define ourselves by limitation. We define ourselves certainly in the ways that we identify with body, with thoughts, with perceptions, with emotions. But somehow it is often a definition of fear, of limitation, of estrangement. Somehow intuitively, in our bones, we know how very fragile and uncertain our life is. We know this, despite all our strategies and whatever, camouflage. We know this, don't we? How our worlds can crumble in a moment. How our lives rest upon so many conditions outside of our control. And we know this. And it's almost as if in that vulnerability, we try to protect that vulnerability by identification, by trying to make something more enduring, more solid, more reliable, by trying to make a me, even if we don't really particularly like the me we make. I think it's Woody Allen or somebody said, or I can't remember who it was, better to be an imperfect somebody than nobody. But we see how we're moving towards that over and over again. Now, this limited definition of me, I think, carries with it this undercurrent of anxiety, of fear of injury, fear of harm, fear of pain, fear of failure, fear of not being good enough. And fear is a kind of ill will. In fact, this is how often the Buddha defined aversion, as fear, which actually I think really puts aversion into a different kind of referencing, doesn't it? Because we're so prone to kind of judge aversion, but to understand how much aversion is the way that we're trying to protect from a fear of injury or a fear of loss or a fear of criticism, then I think it is probably possible to feel a great deal more compassion for those surges of aversion and ill will, rather than just defining them as imperfections or failures, to how it's almost as this is how we're responding to intrinsic vulnerability, is through aversion. Now, it almost doesn't occur to us that a freer and wiser and perhaps kinder way of approaching that intrinsic vulnerability would actually be to turn towards it. To learn to stand in the midst of it, to learn to turn towards it with kindness and with courage and with compassion, and to learn to soften and open. Because we really begin to see how that identification, that manifestation of fear is the primary ground upon which ill will really thrives. But the other, I think, condition upon which ill will, what really suffocates metta, the primary condition that suffocates metta, is almost the kind of companion of ill will, which is craving. I mean, these two are constantly interchanging, aren't they? Aversion and craving. They're just like two sides, really, of the same coin. The Buddha once said that the path of those who cultivate metta is a path of those who are learning to be at ease in the midst of all conditions. Now, we do see that ill will is a kind of aversion. It's an enactment of a belief, but so is craving. Craving comes to this same kind of centralization of our ideologies about self. Craving is actually an enactment of a belief in insufficiency, which is also a kind of fear, isn't it? That I don't have enough inwardly. You know, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. I'm incomplete in some way. And so I go around the world looking for that which is going to make me more complete. It's another abandonment of what is. So much of this pathway is, you know, when we hear the word contentment, I think it's very easy to think of cats in front of a fire or cows in a field, you know, but the kind of contentment that the Buddha speaks about is not a bovine contentment, you know, kind of passively grazing our way through life. It is actually it's a contentment of understanding where there's an ending to those beliefs in insufficiency. And that is actually when we're no longer a hostage to the world of conditions. Without contentment, we're always elsewhere, aren't we? A better moment, a better body, a better walking practice, a better partner, a better experience, you know, a better event, certainly a better mind. And that is abandonment. And a lot of part of metta is this capacity for contentment. To stand near to all things with friendliness, learning to calm and to release some of that agitation and to be upright, upright in the moment, rather than leaning forward into the future or backward into the past. If there was going to be a mantra of metta, it would be this too, this too. That kind of inclusivity. So the conditions for metta to arise, not something that is forced, but conditions that are cultivated. Non-identification. We learn this in our practice. We actually learn to see the thoughts, the sensations, the ideas, the memories, the emotions that arise, and we begin to see them as emotions, memories, thoughts, not descriptions of me, not descriptions of who I am. Non-identification is a condition upon which metta arises. Contentment is one. Mindfulness is one. Integrity is another. These are all conditions we cultivate, but so too is courage. Now, it's not easy for any of us to stand near to sorrow or blame or pain or illness. It's not easy for any of us to stand near to difficult people and emotions. And it's so important to see that metta is not about somehow just being nice. It's not about a kind of sentimentality. In fact, that's kind of the near enemy of metta. But it is about courage. To be still amidst the waves of aversion. This is really swimming against the tide, isn't it? Swimming against the tide of our own impulses. swimming against the tide of our own reactivity. To be still in the midst of an unpleasant sight or a sound, in the midst of a body, when we catch sight of a person we fear or dislike, you see how quickly the mind wants to move into judgment or stories or avoidance, and to stand still. You know, it seems so much easier to be aversive than to cultivate friendliness. It's almost as if the mind clings to the pathways that are familiar, that it knows. And this is a place where mindfulness and metta are really going hand in hand. Learning how to pause, just for a moment. Learning how to pause, to stop for a moment, instead of abandoning. Learning that quality of uprightness and courage, rather than fleeing. Because we see that fleeing, the patterns of flight in our life, they reinforce the kind of foundations of fear. They reinforce the patterns of ill will. And in a way, flight is a way that we deliver the well-being of our own hearts into the hands of conditions or into the hands of another person. We sometimes think, you know, the small moments of aversion don't really matter. Do you know, sometimes we even like them. I notice a big one for me is driving. It's almost like when I get in a car, it's like a license for aversion to arise. You know, impatience. And what is that? You know, I think, you know, like why am I thinking that person's just some sort of jerk on the road, you know, out to get me, you know? And I think this is a place where I practice. This is a place where I practice. And in a way, we all kind of know the places where we need to practice, don't we? It's not like they're mysteries. It's the places almost where we can be enchanted with aversion. And we think that the small moments of aversion don't really matter. But our participation in them, of course, is the building blocks for the much bigger moments of aversion and anger, frustration and judgment and blame. You know, there's a saying in the Tibetan tradition. He says, you know, do not think these small moments of ill will make no difference, that it takes only a spark to set a mountain on fire. He also says, you know, don't ever think that these small moments of kindness and compassion make no difference, because the great oceans are filled drop by drop. We don't have to love the difficult, but we may not have to feel so powerless before it. We may not feel that we have to abandon it. We may begin to see that this is where we plant the seeds of metta over and over. And it's not just about what we feel, it's about what we do. It's about actually what we commit to in the moment. So my understanding, the cultivation of metta always has been a path of awakening, illuminating the places where ill will can live and cast its shadow. It's a path of knowing that kind of toxic power of ill will in our own lives, and to know that ill will is suffering. And as suffering, it merits metta. And it merits compassion as much as anyone or anything in this world. And its cultivation really lies in any moment. I want to end actually with a story. A young man who just completed his spiritual training and was eagerly intent on becoming a teacher moved to a new town. He tried to teach, but no one came. The only spiritual interest in the town were the many followers of a wise and well-known rabbi. Frustrated, the young teacher devised a plan to embarrass the old master and gain students for himself. He captured a small bird and one day went to where the master was seated, surrounded by many disciples. And holding the small bird in his hand, he spoke directly to the master. If you are so wise, tell me now, is this bird in my hand alive or is it dead? And his plan was this. If the master said the bird was dead, he would open his hand, the bird would fly away, the master would be wrong, and students would come to him. If the master said the bird was alive, he would quickly crush the bird in his hand and open it and say, see, the bird is dead. Again, the master would be wrong, and the young teacher would gain students. So he sat poised in front of the master, demanding an answer. Tell me, if you are so wise, is this bird alive or is it dead? The master looked back at him with great compassion and answered quite simply, really, my friend, it is up to you. And in a sense, like, I think this is what metta is about. You know, it is about really what we are doing, where we are making our home in the moment. Knowing those small moments actually, in a way, are up to us. But I think we are inspired by the reality that every moment we really taste that kind of unconditional friendliness, that unconditional kindness. In a way, it really is a taste of freedom. It really is a taste of the loveliness. It's a taste of the heart really unbound. And I think if there is to be any genuine motivation in the cultivation of the path of metta, it needs to be built upon the loveliness of those tastes of freedom.